were you saying about balance? What do you think work-life balance is in this exam?
It's hard because balance is such an individual concept. And I think that with the idea of balance, it has to come from within in terms of how you feel fulfilled through this whole process. And I know that this exam, you can't be balanced. It, as in, when I say balance, everyone thinks balance is 50-50.
Mm.
Or let's say you've got three things, work, study, family. So what you do is you say balance is one third work, one third study, one third family. I don't think that that modern concept actually exists because sometimes people can be very involved with work and study and have a limited amount of family time and still be considered balanced. And I think the idea needs to be fit into what the situation is.
I agree. I feel like my definition of balance is something about, it's when you prioritize the aspects of your life and they're in line with your goals of life or your values. And if you've got that kind of structure and you know, you're being true to yourself, for example, if you just love money, then it would make sense that, I'm not saying that's a great value, but it would make sense that you would put a lot of time into making money. Whereas if you love family and, you know, spending time with kids and, you know, social, then to spend all your time at work would make no sense. But I think that's where this exam really throws a spanner in the works. You've only got 24 hours in the day. Everyone's got the limits of what they can actually do with their time and, you know, how much time they can spend. And the reality is you need to spend such a lot of time. You know, some people have fantastic memories. Some people have other things going on. And there's all these variables. But it's like you have to create a bit of a different value set for this exam for that 12 months. And that's 12 months out of your lifetime, so it's not so bad. But it does mean that maybe if you value getting this exam for, having a good future, being able to contribute to society and everything else you want out of the job of anesthesia, it means that you might have to put your values of friends and family a little bit less in the priority list just for this exam.
And I like the idea how you talk about putting the concept of the importance of the exam linked to what you can achieve in the future. What you can do is if you value family, you value friends, you value contributing to society, you can almost say that by getting this exam done, it actually will improve your family life, actually improve your ability to contribute to society positively.
Mm.
Because otherwise, I think if you just take it for the exam per se, it really can be quite draining. But I think if you actually allow the idea that this exam allows you to actually achieve what you want in the future,
yeah,
it actually gives you the motivation to actually dedicate a lot more time to it.
That's right.
And create this whole idea of balance.
It's probably a good time to start with the intro. Hi, everyone. It's time for another episode of Anesthesia Coffee Break. I'm Lahiru.
And I'm Stan.
And today we're going to talk about the acceptable low limit of your saturations for a healthy individual, healthy young individual. But first, Stan, we've already talked about balance, but what's your performance tip? How do we achieve balance?
So the idea of balance is quite a enigma where everyone talks about having a balanced life. But we know that for this exam, you have to focus your energies or a majority of your energies towards the study for this exam. So my performance tip is always understand why you're actually studying for this exam.
Mm-hmm.
Sit down before the exam, ask yourself, why do I want to pass this exam? And most people will say, look, I want to pass this exam because it will help me get through training.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as we were alluding to before, you need to have a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have an almost a holistic view in terms of what this exam can provide for you,
yes,
and your family and society.
Yes, it's a bigger picture. When you wake up and you're tired and sleepy and you've got to, you know, study this crazy numbers and pharmacology, just remember that this is because, as we'll go through in every episode, this stuff is really clinically relevant. If you just know how to put a tube and you're just doing the technical side of things, we want you, and I think ANSCA and most of our training wants us to know everything from the physiology, the pharmacology, the technical side of things. We want to be leaders in our profession. We want to I think I always thought that having that baseline level of intense knowledge that we do have allows us not to just be anesthetists, but we could pioneer things in the future because we've got this amazing level of knowledge. And then at the very end of that, the goal is we can contribute to society and do this for our family and whatever other values that we hold.
It's really good to just sit, you know, take a step back and have a think about why are you doing this exam? And doing, I think just sort of knowing that answer will actually give you the energy and the drive you need to really push on.
I think that's great. So to move on with the question, this was a question from the 2014 September paper, question 9. What is the lower limit of SpO2 or saturations you would accept in an ASA1 young male under general anesthesia? Explain your reasons for choosing this value.
Okay, so the way that I would approach this question is that it's a very open question because it actually requires a bit of clinical background, a bit of clinical understanding to actually know what lower limit of SpO2 you would accept. And the key thing is they're asking it in an ASA1 young male under a general anesthesia. So not someone who's ASA3. This is someone who has saturations of 99% on 99 to 100% on room air.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I would start off with a definition quickly of what SpO2 is. So the SpO2 is the fraction of oxygenated hemoglobin relative to total hemoglobin and is related to the partial pressure of the oxygen via the hemoglobin-oxygen dissociation curve. And normal is above 95%. So I'll quickly draw the HbO2 dissociation curve. And that can give you a little basis in terms of how you're going to answer the next bit of question. Because when you draw the curve, it's important to have that, you know, that line where, you know, that steep part of the curve, because that actually creates the reasoning of what lower limit you'll accept.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the lower limit that I would normally accept, or the limit where in terms of danger happens, is when hypoxemia happens.
Yes.
So hypoxemia happens at a saturation of less than 91% or a PaO2 less than 60 millimeters of mercury. Now, obviously, I'm sure for you as well, when you've got an ASA1 young patient on a general anesthesia, you're not going to wait till they're 91% to sort of go, look, something's wrong. You're going to have a little bit of a buffer zone, aren't you?
Yes.
So I would probably accept a lower limit of 94% or less.
Yes.
Just to have that buffer zone to have a think about what would be the potential causes of them to have what I call sort of hypoxemia.
I love that you get clinical with that. So you're essentially saying hypoxemia could become very detrimental at 91%, where a PaO2 is 60 millimeters mercury. But clinically speaking, for a fit young person where you would not even expect this because they're normally 99%, you need time to solve this problem, hence your buffer zone. So you're going to choose a value, you're going to state it 94%, and that's very reasonable. That's what we're definitely kicking to gear at 94%, going, why on earth is this fit young male having hypoxemia?
Correct. So it's very natural for patients to desat a little.
Yes.
Under anesthesia, especially if you're running low FiO2s. Oh, sorry. When I say low FiO2s, let's say FiO2s of 0.3, 0.4.
Yes.
Okay. And with anesthesia, you've got things like decreased tidal volumes causing hypoventilation. And that's probably the main thing that's going to be causing you to decrease your saturations initially. Okay. But once you start getting less than 95% and you're approaching the level of hypoxemia, you have to think about other causes. So potential other causes that includes hypoventilation would also include low FiO2, VQ mismatch, shunt, and diffusion impairment. Now, those things like VQ mismatch, shunt, diffusion impairment, they become almost pathological.
Yes.
All right. And they would be very unexpected.
Yes.
In a fit ASA1.
What I love about this framework, and I have exactly the same framework as I think most of us do for hypoxemia. The first couple are very easy to sort out. You just increase your oxygenation, you increase your ventilation, or check that your ventilation is, you know, reasonable, like 6 liters per minute. And then pretty much most of your causes are really just shunt, I find. And I love that you can quickly, and I've got a video on this on YouTube, really, so it's a bit of a plug for that. But to go through this system is actually quite easy. In fact, that you can just, you know, check your machine and circuit very quickly, and then you just look at your tube, auscultate the lungs, and that probably gives you all your differentials straight away.
Yep, correct. So my steps in terms of if I had an ASA1 patient whose sats were decreasing, I would increase their FiO2 to manage their, if there was potential causes of low FiO2. The other thing that I would do is making sure that they've got adequate alveolar ventilation. So to do that, you either look at tidal volume or you look at reducing physiological dead space. Okay. So to increase their tidal volume, if they were spot venting, you could look at things like if the laryngeal mass is not appropriately positioned and causing some obstruction. Some consultants may start putting in PSV Pro. Mm-hmm. Okay. As discussed before, that's not something that I use. Mm-hmm. But you can certainly do that to increase your tidal volumes. Mm-hmm. And if someone was intubated, you will look at increasing their tidal volumes and making sure they've got adequate paralysis with the idea of reducing physiological dead space. Mm-hmm. So the most common cause of physiological dead space in anesthesia is hypotension. Mm-hmm. Okay. So check their blood pressure, make sure that they've got adequate blood pressure and treat that if necessary. And you wouldn't believe how many times I've seen oxygenation improve with an improved blood pressure.
That's fantastic. And just to clarify then, so your tidal volume is made up, say 500 mils of tidal volume has 350 mils of alveolar volume and then 150 mils of physiological dead space, or yes, anatomical dead space, sorry. And then when you multiply that number by your respirate rate, you get your minute ventilation. So that's 500 times, say, 12 respirate rate. But your minute alveolar ventilation is at 350 of tidal volume multiplied by your rest rate. So correct, you can manipulate that in the way you need to increase your alveolar ventilation through those techniques.
Yeah, correct. Saying. And remember, under anesthesia, it's not just anatomical dead space, but also apparatus dead space as well.
Yeah, that's right.
But we all know that when you put a tube in, it does decrease the dead space from the airway. So in effect, I think of it as quite similar in terms of the ratios. Okay. Yes.
Isn't hypoventilation, the reason you get hypoxemia with hyperventilation, due to just the fact that you're not removing CO2?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, let's get into this.
Okay, so it's a bit of a fallacy because we look at the alveolar gas equation.
Yes.
When we look at the alveolar gas equation, the component at the end,
yes,
is your CO2,
yes,
divided by your respiratory quotient.
Yeah.
Agree?
Yeah.
And a lot of candidates think it's actually the increase in CO2 that causes you to have a lower amount of PaO2.
That's correct. That's a correct statement though, isn't it? If I increase my CO2 due to hyperventilation, my alveolar gas equation will give me a lower reading of PaO2.
Now, you have to understand where it actually comes from, where that formula actually comes from.
Yep.
So it comes from, you have to look at the conservation of mass, all right? So when we think about how CO2 is produced, mm-hmm, okay, so how is CO2 produced?
Oh, so cellular metabolism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you had a formula for CO2, mm-hmm, and its relation to oxygen, what would that look like? It looked like the oxygen multiplied by your respiratory quotient,
yes,
equals your CO2. Because remember, your respiratory quotient basically tells you for every molecule of oxygen you consume, how much CO2 you produce.
Yes.
So already you know that CO2 is a product of oxygen consumption. Now, the other thing about CO2 is that it's related to alveolar ventilation. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, it's probably easier, like I do this in my part one lectures, and it's probably easier to actually show it diagrammatically or graphically. Mm. But when you think about the CO2 and its relation to the respiratory quotient, it's directly related to your oxygen consumption divided by your alveolar ventilation. And it's through the conservation of mass. Now, what that means is that alveolar CO2 divided by your respiratory quotient equals your oxygen consumption divided by your alveolar ventilation. The reason why we don't have that as part of the alveolar gas equation is that it's very hard to measure both oxygen consumption as well as your alveolar ventilation. So already you can already see that formula there is actually related to the oxygen consumption, alveolar ventilation. In other words, it's not that the CO2 is rising that causes your alveolar O2 to drop. Mm-hmm. It's because your alveolar ventilation is decreasing, causing your alveolar O2 to drop. And it's just that as a byproduct, what you see is you see an increase in your alveolar CO2. Now, the other thing that you can think about under anesthesia for a fit ASA1 patient is shunt. So shunt happens when you've got atelectasis, and the way that you would treat that is through recruitment and through the use of PEEP. So happens quite commonly in really large obese patients.
Yeah.
Okay. And what you would do is you'd give them a period of increased airway pressures to help recruit. And then after that, you would institute some PEEP and continue your ventilation.
Yes.
And you can certainly see patients improve with that if they have had shunt.
Yes.
Now, the other two causes of hypoxemia, VQ mismatch and diffusion impairment, they're more pathological. And I would only suspect that once I've done all those steps, and the thing about VQ mismatch is you have to think about that in terms of a pathology that can cause it. So you'd be looking at something like acute pulmonary edema or
even COPD, asthma have very specific profiles of VQ mismatch. Yeah.
But not so related in ASA1, young male. So I'm just trying to think what else could there be in an ASA young male patient. And so
really the common thing is atelectasis.
Yeah. And VQ mismatch will be pulmonary edema, possibly pulmonary embolism. Okay.
Yes. I would almost say that because this question outlines the fact that it's a fit young male, but then they do suffer a low limit, we can assume that something has happened. So maybe you've done something and they've got negative pressure pulmonary edema, or maybe something has happened. They've been in hospital for a long time.
Mm.
You know, they've actually had a pulmonary embolism. So I feel like you can invoke pathological things for this.
It will be, lower down my list, especially clinically as well.
Yes.
And diffusion impairment, very, very unlikely.
Yeah. Okay. You already know they've got diffusion impairment before they've come to you.
Correct. Yes. Correct.
Yeah, good. I think that's a really good summary. And I think as we mentioned before, the way you can rule these things out, turn up your oxygen, turn up your flows, ensure your blood pressure and cardiac output is good. With shunt, you can diagnose this very simply by checking your circuit, getting your hand on the bag, ventilating and auscultating. You can literally rule out most of your causes of shunt just with those simple techniques, and then apply PEEP, recruitment maneuvers, suction catheter, and if they've got bronchospasm, Ventolin or any other such treatments for that. And then really that's a practical way of getting through it. And as I mentioned, I've got a YouTube video on solving these problems, which I'll put the link to.
Yeah, great. So just to summarize, the potential causes of hypoxemia, low FiO2, hypoventilation, VQ mismatch, shunt, and diffusion impairment. Okay.
Fantastic.
Now, the second part of the question is you have to explain your reasons for choosing this value. So what you need to, or how I think about it is that when you've got sats of less than 91%, you're starting to function on that steep part of the curve and where it drops off quite rapidly. Okay. And most patients, especially young ones, should be able to compensate. So it still should give you a bit of time to fix these things. And that's what I would sort of talk about in the next part of in the next section in terms of why I've chosen 94% or less with a buffer zone to the lower limit of 91%. Okay. And the reason for that is an ASA1 young male should have the physiological reserve to compensate for a period of hypoxia. And if you think about in altitude, that occurs naturally. Okay. So they actually can compensate hours to days. So if you had a young patient who was setting at 90%, don't panic. Okay. Like take your time, diagnose, they have the physiological reserve to be able to manage that for some time. All right. And the responses that a fit young patient to increase oxygen delivery to vital organs, what they do is they've got things, they've got strategies like hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction to improve VQ matching. They've got activation of their carotid receptors to increase their ventilatory drive if they're not paralyzed. They get sympathetic activation, so increased peripheral vasoconstriction, increased heart rate, increasing blood pressure. And you'll see that. You see that when a patient has their SATs decreasing and they become hypoxemic, when they're apneic, you'll see that that's a trigger for them to start breathing. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that you'll see is that their heart rate and blood pressure starts to increase. And that's from sympathetic activation.
And these are definitely things you not necessarily do want to test out in practice, but just be reassured that when it happens, it's really reassuring to see this in physiology in motion.
Yeah.
Trying to just optimize your patient.
Correct.
When you're not actually doing it yourself.
And so if you have a patient who is dropping their saturations and you see their heart rate and blood pressure increase, that is a good thing. It's the body compensating to making sure that there's increased oxygen delivery. Okay. What you don't want to see when someone drops their saturations is their heart rate and blood pressure dropping. That is a bad sign.
And that's kind of one of those things that we always prepare for in kids.
Yes.
Hypoxemic and bradycardic.
Correct.
We're in trouble.
You're in trouble.
Intramuscular atropine.
Correct.
And sucks.
Well, exactly. Which is why atropine is there for kids.
Yes.
To making sure that they are able to increase their heart rate, increase their cardiac output, and be able to compensate for the low partial pressure of oxygen.
I wonder if we can relate to this to the exam. When you're in the exam, you may have a fast heart rate and a high blood pressure, and this is your body mobilizing oxygen because you need it right at that moment.
Yeah, correct. Now, the other thing that fit, young, healthy patients can do is that they also have compensation in regional circulations. So they get metabolic vasodilation in important regional circulation. So the two most important is your brain and your heart. Okay, so you get increase in cerebral blood flow. So normal blood flow is about 50 mils per 100 grams per minute. And that equates to a oxygen delivery of 10 mils per 100 grams per minute. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, ischemia only occurs when your cerebral oxygen delivery drops by 50%. So it has to be very significant for ischemia to occur in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there's actually quite a safety margin there. Now, with coronary blood flow, normal blood flow is about 50 to 100 mils per 100 grams per minute with a oxygen delivery of 10 to 20 mils per 100 grams per minute. And you can have that increase up to 4 times, primarily through an increase in flow. Because remember that oxygen extraction in coronary arteries is already almost maximal already. Okay, so your goal is to avoid significant hypoxemia. And given the myocardium's high extraction ratio of more than 60%, it has limited ability to compensate if SATs are less than 80% for more than 5 minutes. And that's what you want to watch out for. If you start having SATs less than 80% for more than 5 minutes, this can lead to ischemia and ultimately cardiovascular collapse.
That sounds really good. I really like that framework. And also, you're able to reproduce quite a few numbers there, but As previously, we can notice patterns in these numbers.
Mm.
The fact that your cerebral blood flow is about 50 mils per 100 grams per minute with oxygen of 10 mils per 100 grams per minute, with oxygen of 10 mils per 100 grams per minute. And the fact that coronary blood flow is very similar, around 50 to 100 versus oxygen 10 to 20.
Yes.
I love these numbers that actually, body just makes it work.
Body just makes it work. and look, what I do is I round off just to make it easy for me to sort of remember these numbers, okay? So obviously when you look at textbooks and you see that, oh, it's a little bit different from the numbers I've quoted, but it should be around what I've said. And the reason why I round off, as I said, is just for ease of memory. I'm getting older, so my memory's getting a lot worse. And what I do is have these little tips and tricks to make it easy on me to sort of remember these things.
And that sounds really good. Now, would you state, you've set the low limit, would you state concern about length of time and would you reflect it back to the time you've mentioned there?
Yeah, so that's where I talked about if you have saturations of less than 80 minutes for more than 5 minutes.
Yes.
Okay. That's what you worry about. So remember, in a fit, healthy patient, you've got room to, when I say room to move, it's more like room to sort of diagnose and treat. Mm-hmm. So when you've got SATs less than 90%, or in fact, when you start getting assessed at 94 or less, start putting in strategies to increase your oxygenation. So increase your FiO2, check your tidal volumes, think about shunt, and then think about VQ mismatch, think about diffusion impairment. And when you start, and if it doesn't improve, and let's say patient comes down to 91, this is when you start calling for help, okay? And what you want to avoid is you want to avoid them reaching less than 80%, because if they're less than 80% for more than 5 minutes, that's when you get trouble in a young, fit ASA1 patient, all right? So even if there was a fit, young ASA1 patient with sats of 85%, mm-hmm. over the period of time, they're actually okay. Mm. I've seen that multiple times. For whatever reason, mm-hmm. you have a patient who briefly drops down to the mid-80s mm-hmm. for a while, and after that, you institute therapy, mm-hmm. they're fixed. They wake up fine, mm. like nothing's happened.
I find that in spite of the fact that the time from action to disaster and anesthesia can be very rapid, we still have enough space and time because we're right there at the point of the event that we have seconds, minutes to solve this, and the body has reserve. It's really reassuring.
Correct. And the most common cause of a fit ASA1 young male patient to drop their sats is primarily postoperatively on extubation. And that you mentioned that before, when they either butt on the tube, butt on the LMA, mm-hmm. and cause negative pressure pulmonary edema. And I've seen that once.
Yeah.
I've seen that once before where they start biting on the tube, create the negative pressure pulmonary edema, they become hypoxemic, mm-hmm. and you actually have, and you see their sats drop, and it's a bit confronting, but you treat that. Mm. So deepen them, reparalyze them, intubate them. And once the sequelae is finished, they're fine because of their body's ability to compensate, because of their body's ability to increase their heart rate, blood pressure, increase the oxygen delivery, or their metabolic compensation. So increasing cerebral blood flow, increasing coronary blood flow, they're able to do all those things. You need to watch out, obviously, for patients who are ASA 3, the older patients, because right. they are not going to be able to tolerate that.
Malus reserve.
Correct.
So I think that's pretty good. I think we've covered that exam question. We've given you a structure and had really some good discussion about some of the practicalities and clinical relevance of this. So thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please rate it and subscribe and share with anyone who's about to sit this exam or simply loves learning physiology and pharmacology and how it relates to clinical practice. And again, just see our disclaimer below. Very important that you use this in the context of each of your patients with adequate supervision. And catch you next time. Thanks a lot.